Let's get back into the woods. This is The Outside Gate with Steve Hall on the L4 Media Network, where we talk US moto and anywhere the conversation goes. With me today is the 1994 National Enduro Champion. He's also a six-time ISDE gold medalist. Steve Hatch, how are you?
Doing great, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
No worries, mate. I remember your name so many times in Dirt Bike Magazine as a teenager. I was reading about your exploits, you know, racing against Scott Summers and the like. But your gig nowadays is training sessions, man. So what have you been up to just lately?
Yeah, I've been super busy since I retired in coaching, mentoring, and training riders from all over the world and different levels, from beginner to pro. My wife and I both do two different companies, the Steve Hatch Racing and then Power the Mind. On the mindset, she works with our riders. So it's been great. Been working with a ton of great riders, and from beginners to pros, and we've really been enjoying it.
Awesome, mate. So what we might do, we'll get right into your training stuff in a little while. But for a start, what I like to do is dig right into people's careers and talk about, your days right from being a mini bike rider. So what was your first bike, and when did the bug bite and really get your love of motorcycles going?
Yeah, so I was 8 years old, and my dad was always into British cars, and he was a 7th, 8th, and 9th grade social studies teacher, but he loved cars and restored them and played with them, so we would go to car shows every weekend. There's a $35 mini bike with an old bridge and strap motor on it, no brakes, pile of junk, basically. I think it was a Montgomery Ward or something. It wasn't even a name brand. And I remember pleading to both my parents, and my mom was a school teacher too, so they kind of knew the psychology of how to keep my sister and I, who was a couple years older, at bay with maybe having to work for stuff, and which was always the norm. And they said, all right, at the time our dishwasher was broke, so they said, if you do the dishes, I think it was $5 a week for 7 weeks, you could get that mini bike. And I said, absolutely, I'm doing it. And they thought, this kid's nuts, he's only 8, he really wants this dirt bike, and this looks like he's really wants it if he's going to do the dishes. So I did the dishes for 7 weeks and earned that mini bike, and have loved it. And then from there, just rode around the field. We had about 15 acres here in upstate New York, which beautiful rolling hills. And just like most kids, just had the biggest grin on my face with bugs on my teeth, and just loved riding out in the field. And my sister had horses and I had dirt bikes, which don't always go hand in hand, but we had our own field, so that was good. And then, I just rode and had a good time that way. And then one of my buddies in middle school, Ethan Goodrich, he said, hey, you should go do a race, when I was 12 years old. And I thought, I don't race, I just ride. But that's really where I got the bug. And then I got in with some unbelievably great riders in New York that were already top champions and winning around here and in some of the nationals. So my friend Ethan and I were young little 12-year-old guys, and these other guys were 20, 25 years old. And I remember used to beat us up and make us tough and get us into headlocks and try to drag us around and pick on us, which is a great idea, but it made us tough and made us not too happy about it. So by the time we got some muscles in 16, 17, 18, we started coming on with a vengeance and then finally beating those guys. So it was the perfect storm of fun, friends. And I think, for most people, we love, the adrenaline rush, but I think a dirt bike really teaches you, especially at that age, that you're not a legend in your own mind. You're not that good, no matter how good you are. And about the time you think you're good, it throws you on your head. So it's like the perfect storm. It doesn't have to be a parent or a friend. It's like this dirt bike really teaches you about life.
It does. Yeah. Your story of having to work for that bike, that, I got a similar thing with my first bike was an XR75 that was just beat to hell. You know, it was a rough as hessian undies, and it didn't run half the time, and had points and all that sort of thing, and anyway, it didn't last too long before we couldn't even start it. And then I got my eyes on an XR80 that was at the local deal. That was it was pretty new at the time. It was like a secondhand. Someone had bought it and not used it much, and I wanted it bad. And I worked part time at my dad's tire shop from when I was 12 years old. So I'd saved up a fair bit of money. You know, I'd work school holidays. I'd work, you know, after school, all that sort of thing, Saturday mornings. And I had about $500 and the bike was $800. Oh. And my dad had just built a huge new shed, and on the back wall, to save money, he used secondhand iron. So it was 60 foot long and about probably 10 foot high of secondhand iron. And he said, and he had this big, big old drum of silver paint. And he said, you've got to wire brush and sand all that old tin and give it two coats of this paint. They used to call it, silver frost or something like that. This real old school silver paint. Give it two coats of silver, and that'll pay off that $300, and you get the bike. And so I did that, and I earned that bike, and I looked after that bike so well, you know, like it was my pride and joy. So I still drive past that old shed where we used to live now, and it's, you know, it's 40 years later nearly, and that paint job still looks good, so I even did a good job. So there you go.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It makes you appreciate things, doesn't it? Yeah,
sure does. Yeah, I was thinking that. I think I just rode my blue jeans until I think probably till 12, till I started racing, and then hand me down pants from my buddies type of thing, dirt bike clothes. And then I think my first real bike had to be, it was a 1985 Husqvarna was the first bike, but that was about five or six bikes in, and a 125. We used to joke, my buddy and I used to work on those all week long, the DNF every weekend, because they were piles back then, the ones we got at least. And anyway, but you're right. When you earn something and you understand the value of a dollar and you have to work for your bikes and your, you know, entry fee. I remember my dad had, like I said, he had different cars going to the car shows, but I'd sand the cars down all day on Saturday, usually 8 hours, because I wasn't really proactive like I should have been as a little guy. But I'd work for those 8 hours, and I think he was giving me, I forget, even $5 an hour or something. But it was enough for my starting gate, which used to be 25, and $15 to my buddies that had a truck and took me there, because I didn't even have a truck or anything for years and years. So yeah, I think it's pretty cool when guys like ourselves have to earn it. And then, like you said, you take care of a lot better if you're the one paying for it and you realize you work your butt off for it.
Yeah. I've told the story before. I was terrible at over revving everything. And until the first time I paid for and rebuilt my own motor. And then I was like, I stopped all of that. I was like, you know, you see, like, wow, these parts are like really small, and like, and I've had to pay for them. And like, yeah, there's no, after that, I was warming everything up nice and not over revving it and all that sort of thing. Awesome. You might still over rev something if you're mid race and there's some damn hill you got to get up, and you got to over rev an underpower bike to get up it or something. But like, that'd be the only time, you know, so.
That's great. Absolutely. Reality hits in, right, when it's coming out of your pocket.
Yeah. You see it with, you know, like not for a little while, but I was pretty involved in running races, or running off-road races here in Victoria for a while there. And you get to know the kids and the families and all that real well. And yeah, you see both sides. You see the kids who really, really appreciate it, and their parents are making them earn it. And then you see some kids, unfortunately, that's just everything's handed to them. And it's no surprise that the kids that had to work for it hard are the ones that are still doing really well as adults in the racing. So, yeah, it, you know, and whereas the others are long gone from it, you know, because they've moved on to just trying something else, you know. So, yeah. I'm sure you come across a lot of those mindsets and that sort of thing in your training too, hey?
Yeah, for sure. You know, that was part of it as I got into, like most riders, going, whoa, this is a physical sport, you know, once you especially get into the racing side of it. So I really got in and loved the training side. I was in other sports, you know, football, baseball, basketball and stuff. And then then actually in ninth grade, I got a foot injury that basically where my foot wouldn't grow fast enough for my bones. So I couldn't run anymore. So I actually got into tennis and got into skiing, but that hurt my feet. And then I got into dirt bikes. So it's the perfect storm. But yeah, the mindset side was all about the training. And I love the training. I love the mindset of pushing yourself. And I had runs called the Devil's Playground, running up and down, you know, about 5 miles worth of hills by my parents' house growing up, and all the training. And, you know, the mindset part of it is, you know, working on building you to have that resilience built in. And that's, you know, you can't fake fitness. So that was one of the things I knew even before I got to the race, that if I could be more fit than most of the guys in my class, then I could, you know, already be racing 5 guys instead of 50 guys. So that was, excuse me, one of my biggest strengths and one of the things I really love to do and still do, still into the training. And especially with our riders, that's one thing I say, you can't fake speed and you can't fake fitness. So we earn those way outside the starting gate and the races. And those are some of the controllables we can control before we get to the race. Some things at the races just happen, first turn crashes or whatever, or bike's not working or whatever you have. But a lot of the things we can control, and I make sure to bring our riders in peak performance. And it comes a lot from trial and error and doing it wrong, and then at times doing it right.
Yeah, I always really, really respect the fit guys. Yeah, that's what I love. You know, when it comes to off-road stuff, I love long races, even for myself, you know. And I don't race much, but I'm no good at it, but I enjoy it, so I don't do it much. I try and do like one a year just to keep in it, you know. So but yeah, I always really I love long races. I like to see the guys that have really earned it through fitness winning things. I hate, we have a lot of events here in Australia, and a lot of the time it just comes back to the dusty conditions why they do it. They just run like sprint events, like time sprints, just so they can separate everyone, because there's no water to water, there's no rain, you know, there's no rain or there's no water to water things or whatever. So it's just in the dust. Otherwise, you just, no one can see anything, you know. So they run these sprints events and you know, you'll get guys that just they aren't fit, but they're really fast. They're just back on their, you know, skill set, who'll turn up and win something like that. And I hate that, because like, yeah, if this was a 3 hour, you wouldn't have a chance. But you know, they sort of come off the couch they come off the couch and win it because it's a 10-minute sprint, you know, and they'll get the best times for the day and that sort of thing. But I love the love that long races and seeing people really, yeah, just grit it out. I love the kids that are training hard and that sort of thing. So yeah, I certainly see what you're saying there. We might just move into your pro career, I guess. So yeah, what was your first like pro race, or your first National Enduro, GNCC or whatever?
Yeah, so I kind of went everywhere early, meaning even as a younger kid, like 12 to 16, did motocross, turned pro at 16 in that. So I raced that a lot, which was good for starts and different things and aggressiveness. Did the local like hair scrambles, won those championships, which were like 2 hours back then. Got into enduros. Once you're 16 in New York, you could ride on the road. So got in the enduros, got in the hair scrambles. And then also got into 6 days. So kind of a conglomeration, but really my career kind of took off, if you will. And I was simultaneously going to college. So having school teachers for parents, it was kind of an expectation of to get my college degree. So I did in business, a 2-year degree, and then economics and management science, my 4-year degree, while starting to travel and race professionally all over the United States for Suzuki. So I guess the biggest, best one that probably put my name on the map, if you will, was right here in upstate New York, which obviously, go figure, right? It always helps to have one in your backyard where you're already fast in that type of terrain. But Randy Hawkins, Dave Bertram from the factory Team Suzuki days came to town, and one of my mutual friends who was mentoring and helping me said, man, it'd be great. Those guys usually like to test on Friday. And through the dealership I was riding for, they came in, signed autographs, and I got to meet him, kind of do the shake and howdy. But I'm like, hey, got some great places you guys could test your bikes and kind of ride them in on Friday, and the race is Sunday. They said, yeah, we'd love to. So met them out there and had a ball with them. And, you know, of course they're my heroes. So I was like, oh my God, I can't believe these guys with a badass, you know, factory Suzuki yellow box van and all the shiny bikes. And I had an old number 448 Suzuki with a bald, you know, motocross tire on it, doing motocross mostly in stock suspension. So when they came to town, I was pretty impressed, and they're pretty impressed going, wow, this kid's riding this pile for the most part. Cause I wasn't getting help yet. This was kind of like, I was in the 250A class, but they raced that race, which was cool. The Speedsville National Enduro. So it had to be probably 1989-ish. And they put me on the road with Dave Bertram. And then Randy Hawkins, I think, was the row behind us, I want to say, or in front. I can't remember which, but a minute apart. And it didn't really matter, because about halfway through the race, especially that towards the end of it, because I was all over Dave Bertram, which was kind of by, as you know, if you follow somebody, it's 10 times easier than them reading the trail. So I was keying off of him. So that was, felt pretty easy. I was like, wow, I can't believe I'm staying with him. So at the last section, he actually waved me by and let me go in front of him and pin it. And I ended up fourth overall at my first National Enduro from the 250A class. So like, wow, this kid's pretty good. And then the next weekend was Michigan, which I'd been training in the sand in Florida a lot before this, in the off season, in between, like when I had a college break. And they went testing with me that time. And they're like, knowing I was pretty quick, if you will, crazy, but quick, typical motocrosser, right? Mentality. So in the sand whoops, I was even faster. And they're like, well, we're not putting you on with Dave. We're putting you on with Randy, who was number one at the time. And I remember a funny story, Steve, in the first test, I'm pinning it. I'm going through there. I'm following him. So again, it's decently easier for the second guy, of course, especially if you're similar speeds. And he crashes in a turn right in front of me. And I'm like, oh, Randy, you know, and I'm waiting. He's like, go, Steve, go. And I'm like, all right. So I just pin it like crazy in front of him. And it was maybe another couple of miles to the check-in. And I slide in first. And they're all expecting the number one guy, of course, to come in the checkpoint first. And I came in front of him. And then he was only a couple seconds behind me. But so I literally beat him in the first section, if you will. And anyway, I think I got second overall at that first real race that I raced with those guys. Randy, I think, won, and I got second, but it was pretty cool. But, you know, those guys really put me under their wings and really helped. And Randy's been a, you know, one of my best friends, still is. And we were best men in each other's weddings. So, you know, it's one of those things, this sport is so cool that you get to meet really neat people that are down to earth. They're the salt of the earth, if you will. And they're tough, but they're nice. And they're mentally strong, but they're kind. You know, I've lifted, and I know you had Scott Plessinger on here, but I've literally lifted the bike up and off of Scott Plessinger on the last lap. He cartwheeling down a hill. We were racing for the win with like 2 miles to go. He cartwheeled down, and for some reason there was like a fence at the bottom, and he flipped into it, and he stuck under his bike. And I remember seeing his goggles and his eyes looking at me, and the pipe was there. So it kind of scared me. I'm like, oh man, I can't let him burn. I just wanted to win for sure, but I didn't want to burn him. So I literally ran, I leaned my bike, I ran back, picked the bike up just so he could get out, because he was stuck. It was like literally on his chest. Couldn't get his muscle to get it off of him. And he gets up and he starts kicking as fast as he can. I look back, I run to my bike, I'm kicking. I'm like, oh man, if he beats me now, I'm going to be mad, because he's like, so we pin it to the finish. I'm still in front of him. He's on my butt. I mean, we're this close for the next 3 miles, and I'm passed across the finish line, and he was right behind me. So I won, and I stopped and I pushed him, and he's like laughing. And I go, if you would have beat me, I would have been so mad. I've been fighting him for that one, because I literally helped him get out from underneath his bike. But we still joke about that one. But yeah, it's just kind of cool to be with these guys that are just gnarly, and you race hard and everything else. But something like that, where it's like really physical, somebody might be hurt or injured, we're all going to stop. You know, it's not motocross, supercross, where there's 100 people that could go and grab the bike off. We're in the middle of the woods with nobody around.
Yeah. It's one of the big differences with off-road to moto, isn't it? Where it's like, you know, yeah, it's just like it's not a rule. It's just a respect thing that, you know, if someone's in a bad way, you help them out. So yeah,
totally.
It's a funny thing. I know we would say to the, to juniors and that sort of thing, and to seniors, if you, you know, especially if you stop to help an injured guy, you know, we would try and figure it out and reset your times and make it worth your while to stop and help someone, because, you know, there's only so many sweep riders and people out there that can, you know, that can tend to someone if they're hurt. So, you know, I mean, even the last off-road race I did, it was very just last November, and I crashed and I rang me bell pretty good. You know, I was seeing the little birds and the stars like the cartoons, and not a huge crash. I just landed on my head, but my bike's sideways, and it's a single track, like, you know, through the trees. I clipped a tree with me bars, you know, and speared me into a stump, but my bike's sideways across the track, and there's this guy there, and I'm like seeing stars, and I'm like, I just want to pick my bike. I don't want to hold him up because he was a fast guy too, but he's still there. Instead of like yelling at me to get out of the way, like if it was moto, they'd be yelling at you to get out of the way. He's like, "Are you all right, mate?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I've picked up my bike all like this." And then I was like, "Go, mate, go!" You know. So yeah, it's a different atmosphere, isn't it? Yeah, like I always say, moto people, that moto pit sort of atmosphere, it's still cooler than any stick and ball sports, but the off-road pits is even cooler, you know, for the atmosphere. It's a real sort of family environment, isn't it? Yeah, so it's great. Yeah, good fun. Your title in 1994, tell us a bit about that season.
Yeah, that was a crazy cool season. You'll like my mentality on the mindset you asked about earlier. So I went out to Arizona beforehand, and my wife and I moved out there for 17 years, way after this whole episode, but this is back in 94. So I went out there a week early to train, test, get ready for, I'm pretty sure it was round one, and wasn't the smartest thing I did, but I put on a full body wetsuit because I was into jet skiing and went running for like 6 miles in the like 105 degree heat, and saw pink elephants and stars and thought I was going to pass out. And I was by myself, of course, but I didn't die. So that was the good news. But I did a lot of stupid stuff like that on the physical side to see if I could mentally and physically go through it, because I knew none of those other riders were that stupid, smart, dumb, whatever you want to call it, that were going to do that same mentality. So that's how it started, and I won that first race by a few minutes, I think. So I was stoked, and that's really set the tone. And interestingly, though, Steve, out of that whole season of 94, and I was pretty fast in 93, but I just messed it up a lot, kind of being a rookie and younger, or young in it, I should say. In 94, out of the 9 National Enduros, I had broken bones in 5 of them, but I still had 6 wins, and I think a second, a third, and like 1/5 or something like that. So I still had pretty good, but I was definitely cartwheeling and pushing the limits. And that one felt really good to win that championship. And that was something that I really strive for and still proud about, for sure.
Awesome. Who was your rival that year? Who was your biggest rival? Your biggest, who was second, I guess?
Yeah, that year it was Kevin Hines, actually. He was from New England, badass trainer guy also. Randy Hawkins was in it, but something happened. I think he might have broke his wrist the year before, so he wasn't quite as fast that year or something. Jeff Russell, a bunch of guys. But, you know, back then, for the most part, I mean, we're friends, as you could tell, but not really once the goggles went on, right? So I think everybody was a rival, and I had many rivals. Rodney Smith, who ended up being a teammate and a brother-in-law, he was a big rival, but we pushed each other to be first and second in the GNCCs for years and different things. So had a lot of rivals. Shane Watts, one of your guys over there in Australia, we had some good battles. He was definitely fast and hard to beat when he came here, but it was fun. So I think you look back and go, man, I remember Rodney Smith. I literally had a dart through his head on my wall with a cycle gear picture of he and I colliding in a corner. I didn't like him much, to say the least. So I think you have to have some sort of inspiration to want to beat him. I would definitely still pick the bike off of him if they needed it, and it was a last resort, but you definitely wanted to win. And there's a few that rubbed you a little wrong that you really wanted to win. So pretty neat to have those rivalries though, for sure.
Yeah. I think your career, you know, especially like thinking GNCC, it spanned like almost, you know, some really cool, maybe from my perspective, the coolest era of the sport, of the GNCCs. Like you had So you had like the Summers Pleasinger sort of era, you know, when you were early days, and then, you know, Rodney Smith, Barry Hawke, and yourself, you know, the sort of in your heydays. And then even did your last career, is that when Salmonen arrived? Your last yeah. NFC season was Salmonen. So you got to see this guy, yeah. this crazy European come in and just change the sport. So yeah, some pretty amazing things, you know. That was for me that, you know, I loved the bikes of that era too. I loved the last of those, you know, just those, the two stroke, the converted motocross bikes with the clear tanks and, you know, clear tank and 18 inch rear wheel and they're pretty much just a motocross bike. You know, I just thought those bikes looked so cool. I still love bikes with clear tanks, and I think it's because of how all those bikes look. That was sort of the go-to look. And tell us a bit about, yeah, like any of those riders, like maybe tell us a bit about Juha, about Salmonen, and when he arrived. What did you think, you know, when you first saw him in action?
Yeah, well, he was definitely a freak of nature and ballet on a bike and so fast that I knew we were in trouble. And that was towards the end of my career. I actually had the opportunity to, Paul Edmondson came over and raced with us on the Suzuki team, and similar deal. They were both similar, meaning they kind of came from the trials background. They were light on the bike. They were fast. They were precise, kind of everything that we weren't. We were, I think, you know, I mean, the great Scott Summers, Scott Plessinger, that's kind of when I came into it, and they were gnarly. And when I never even saw, I saw them about half the race back in the day when I first started the JNCCs. And then after the gas, they just grabbed two more gears. And I thought, well, where'd they go? You know, nobody told me like, hey, we're going now or anything. So it took me a while to figure it out that they were dropping the hammer then. But as we trained and we got better, we were pretty much dependent on the terrain. If it was, you know, deep mud or something like that, we weren't going at 100% the whole 3 hours. But if it was a good race and good conditions, we could pretty much push 100% all 3 hours because we were just so conditioned. But yeah, Juha was definitely one. When he came over, we all saw the writing on the wall that it was going to be a long few years, because we knew he had a 2-year contract. And that was, like I said, towards the end of my career. And then I knew David Knight was going to be right behind him. So I knew everybody was going to be in trouble again. So I got out at the perfect time, in my opinion. But yeah, you know, those guys and the Europeans, you know, don't quite do like the, I think we get our style, good or bad, in the enduros with the point and shoot and pin it. And you can't lay into the corners because the tree will rip your shoulder off. So we can't really flow, where those guys are so good at carrying momentum and flowing. And, you know, you can get away with it more, especially in like the world championships and the 6 days and stuff like that. It's usually a little bit wider and you have more flow, kind of like moto style. So you can lay it over. Where in the enduros, you know, especially in the United States, a lot of them were so tight, you could barely get your handlebars through. So your bike, you really kept it upright. Where in the faster stuff or stuff more open, you could lay it down like in moto and really carry your corner speed. So a little bit different. But Juha and Paul Edmondson and Shane Watts and all those guys had insane corner speed. You know, we learned from them, obviously, and we raced them, obviously, in 6 days. But they were different. They didn't, you know, rev the bike out, like you said. They kind of short shifted, they flowed, the suspension wasn't totally collapsed. I rode the bike and I loved it, but, you know, aggressive. And my whole thing was on my crossbar pad, I had controlled aggression because my aggression was off the roof. I want to rip the handlebars off and throw it in there. And my finesse on the scale of 1 to 10 was probably a 1 or maybe 2 on a good day. But my determination was a 15 and my aggressiveness was a 20. So it was entertaining. It hurt a lot, but it was fun. And I enjoyed it because I was pinning it and feeling like nobody else is this crazy that was just going to pin it through this stuff. So it was different style. They were faster because they were not sliding maybe as much. And I was definitely sliding a little too much, meaning spinning, coming in and out of the corners a little too aggressive. As I learned their style, I actually slowed down to my 90%. And that was my fastest pace on a stopwatch. My slower pace was way faster, and, you know, stopwatch never lies. We think as riders, like, nobody's this crazy or going this fast. And then you look at the times, you're like, oh my God. So there was a few guys going faster. I don't know how. So Juha was definitely one of them. A lot of those Europeans changed the ability to learn how to ride like they did, because they were winning 6 days and they were faster than us, plain and simply. They weren't quite as good at the 3 hours because that's all we did. So we were pretty gnarly on the physical side. but on the riding skill side, they were good. The mindset, I think we were maybe a little tougher to begin with, but once they got both, they were big bad news for all us Americans for a while.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Good, cool story I have about you know, what you're saying about, you know, being smoother. I helped run so our major series here is Australian Off-Road Championship, and I helped build a track and run one of those events there, good while back now. Anyway, this was when Toby Price was winning that series before he got into rally and all that sort of thing. He was dominating. Anyway, we had this section where you come up out of a dry creek, so it was sort of, you know, it was a jump, I guess, and then it sort of laid in pretty quickly into an off camber left, and we knew that all the bunting and everything was going to get blown out. We knew everyone was going to blow that corner out. So I was sweet riding the event, so I was stationed out there because I knew the first lap we're going to be banging these stakes in and fixing this bunting up like constantly. So I was sitting there, and first lap comes around. Of course, it was a 3-hour cross country. The first lap comes around, and of course, Toby's in front. And he got maybe 18 inches at most of air out of this creek. Got back to traction, peeled around this corner super smooth, and just disappeared. And it was, I'm thinking like, that's all good. And then as the riders progressed, they jumped further out and further out. And by the time like the B graders came through, they were just launching out, and every single one of them was blowing out this corner. And in the end, I was just like, oh, screw this. I just moved the corner out a bit because I was like, you know, I moved it out about another 6 feet because it was just, we would have been fixing it all day. But that always stuck in my mind that, like, you know, the guy that was the fastest by far didn't look the fastest. If there was someone there who was not a rider, and they looked at that, and you showed them one of these B graders launching out and then wheel spinning and crossed up through the bunting and all that sort of thing, I think, damn, that guy's fast. And then if you showed them Toby, his line, they'd be like, he's not as fast. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense that, yeah.
Yeah. When the wheels are spinning, even though it sounds fast, looks fast, it's not always fast because it's like a top fuel dragster when you have two of them and one just sits and spins and the other guy's already gone out the other end of the straightaway. You're like, I guess spinning doesn't really help.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And ever since then, I've been lucky enough to, you know, to watch and help at events and even try and follow at times some super fast Aussie guys. And yeah, the super fast ones are super smooth nowadays. So yeah. Dude, what's your most memorable single race? Like a race where you were just feeling the flow, you were just in the zone. That, you have one particular one like that?
Sure. Yeah. It was 1997. It was Ocala, Florida, which was the round one of the GNCCs. So that's like probably the, back in my day, that was like the biggest, baddest one to do good at. If you only had one, I mean, you want to do good the whole season, but all the big brass are there from Japan, from Suzuki, from all the bike weeks during that same time. So we had lots and lots of fans and sponsors and people in from all over the world. So that's a good one to do good at. And I'd just gotten married to my wife, my dream girl, and we're still married after 25 years. So blessed with that. So that was the year before, but we trained our butts off, you know, and I always did, but like really precisely perfect on nutrition, perfect on everything. And came into that season like a caged lion and couldn't wait. And that day I just pulled the whole shot. And now back then we had, I think, almost 40 guys coming in the first turn because they didn't have all the different pro classes, but it was awesome. And Ty Davis and I battled for like half the race. And then I remember I just dropped the hammer and dropped him. And I think I ended up winning by 3 minutes. So that was, and I don't remember much of it besides the finish line and being so excited. And, you know, they wrote some articles, which was really cool. I was, you know, like back then Air Jordan was the, you know, when Michael Jordan was the cool guy. So they're like, yeah. Air Hatch and this and that, like he outsmarted, outflew him. And, you know, it just felt like in the zone, which, You know, we all have those perfect flow days where you're just like, man, you just, everything feels effortless, slow motion, and you're just doing your passion and purpose on this earth. And that was that day. It was just so much fun. And to win was awesome. So that was probably the best race I think I've ever had for a lot of reasons, but that was so cool.
Yeah. It's an amazing feeling. I honestly, at my skill level on a bike. Yeah. So I always say that it proves how much I love riding that I'm a 48 year old who's still a C grader. So, and I still love riding a lot. So if you suck at something, but you love it so much, you know, like, cause most people who aren't that good, they give it up much younger, you know. So, but I don't reckon I've ever felt that sort of perfect flow feeling on a dirt bike. But I raced cars for a while, which I was good at, and I felt that in a car. So yeah, there was a couple of races there where I was just like, everything was just effortless and perfect, and the car was perfect and that sort of thing. So I do resonate a little bit with that. We might move into a bit of 6 days talk. So 6 days for me, I think it's sort of, I look at it as the pinnacle of off-road in the world. I might be a bit biased because I've had some people I know race it, win it, that sort of thing. But I just love that event. It's been really disappointing, the lack of support for Australian riders the last few years to get them there. You know, we've been very good at times, we've won it and that sort of thing. So as have you guys. Yeah, so you want to tell us a bit about that, and then also too, were you at Cessnock? Did you race the Australian one back in, is that 92, I think?
Yeah, good memory. Yep, I was there. Yeah, I agree with you, Steve. I think it's the pinnacle of the sport, hands down. It's the Olympics of motorcycle riding for dirt bike riders, and the camaraderie and the feeling of your country, all that stuff. I think it's probably always was my favorite race of the whole year. And I'm good buddies with Josh Strang and a bunch of the guys, and love all the Australians anyway. So it's fun to see the battles, and we're all quite similar. You know, the Americans and the Australians, in my opinion, are not only speak the same language, which is cool, but you know, kind of that tough mentality and just tough it out, if you will. So for me, I started it in 1990. It was my first year in Sweden, which is one of the toughest ones, quite a lot like New York, believe it or not, they said. I didn't know until I got there, but I was on the junior trophy team right out of the gate. So that was cool. Nervous, everything else, a funny quick story on it. I was putting my tire in, you know, you only had back then 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes at night to work on your bike and change your tires. So I'm like stressing about that, of course, as a new racer. And I didn't want to let the team down and USA down and everything else, of course. So I've been practicing in my garage for months. So we get there, I'm ready to do day one. I get it, and the bikes are mud. I mean, like, you can't see anything on them. It's really muddy. It rained for like a week before the whole race. And anyway, I'm in there and in the pits in the Parc Fermé. My mom's on the other side. My sister and mom went this time. And I'm working on my bike, and I'm all in my helmet still and sweating, and it's been a long day, and it's raining. And I hear this, hey, Steve. And I'm like, God, that's my mom. Like, I literally have 10 minutes. Doesn't she know I have 10 minutes? Like, why is she calling me? She can talk to me afterwards. You know, we've got the rest of the night to go back to the hotel and talk. And I'm working on my bike, trying to put the rear wheel together. Hey, Steve. I'm like, what, mom? She's like, that's not your bike. And I literally was putting it in my teammate's bike, which both were yellow Suzuki's, both had green number plates and were side by side. And I'd get my wheel done first and was putting it into his bike. So that was actually pretty good that she told me before I tricked his bike out more than mine. So I pulled it out of his and put it in mine, of course. But yeah, it's just fun. The camaraderie, you know, the machine, the being a good mechanic, the being fast, the saving your bike, the endurance, the mindset to be that tough for the whole time. It's just brutal for everybody. And they're all different, of course. And I did 8 of them, and all of them were different. Some were some of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, and some were decently easier. But, you know, you have friendships from those things that you still remember those guys. And when you see them, you still reminisce. So I think it's really cool. And it's really fun to see, you know, you guys doing great with the Australia winning a bunch. It is a bummer. And, you know, I know a lot of countries kind of come and go with the finance, which is frustrating and not easy. And then, yeah, the States, we've really, you know, pushed really hard with Auntie, U-Haul's mechanic that became the KTM head guy. He's been really spectacular and really knew a lot, obviously doing the world championships over there with U-Haul and different riders. So he really helped up the game hands down. Then I've been helping on the side, doing some pro coaching for them for the trophy, junior trophy and women's team for the last few years, which is super fun, but it's neat to see. And it's just a whole other level. You know, you watch the top teams that are winning. It's not everything, but it's like that, you know, 4 to 6% difference, which is everything at that level. And some countries don't have maybe the rider pool to pull from. But when you really have the top, you know, five or so teams, it's crazy how fast and close all those riders are, guys and gals.
Yeah, yeah. It's such a hard thing to win, really, because of the you know 6 days and 4 riders, and that, you know, you've got to get good results. You know, you can have one guy drops off a bit, but you're not much, you know, and you can still win if one guy drops off a bit. But yeah, it's such a hard thing to win. You know, I know there's been years where we've had you know, I mean, I remember so I know the Sanders family fairly well, and Daniel, I know Daniel's dad, Pete, great bloke. I know him really well, and I watched Daniel sort of grow up and racing juniors and through to that. So when he won, I think that was 2019 when he won outright. That was just amazing. But yeah, I mean, I think that year he won outright, but you guys won the trophy because I think maybe two of our guys finished, you know. So it's and even back to the fundraising, I remember going to a fundraiser to help get him there, you know. It's so a fundraiser, yeah, where he did, I forget what it was, but he did a sort of a come and ride with him and watch him ride day, and the kids paid and families paid to come and ride with him and watch him and all that, and he put on a show for everyone and all that to help get him there. I remember being there that day. And then he goes and wins the whole damn thing, but there, you know, Australia's not coughing up any money for it. You know, like, this guy just won the Olympics, you know. How about paying him to go next year? But yeah, that's always a frustrating thing. But that's the same for you guys too, you know, like you guys would be holding fundraisers as well. I remember for the Motocross of Nations, who was it? They were trying to hold golf tournaments and stuff to raise money to get for the Motocross of Nations. So it's crazy, the crazy things like that sometimes, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it shows how bad everybody wants to go, right? When you're selling t-shirts and you're doing your fundraisers and you're really all in, and these are, you know, the top guys, and we still do it here. So, and the golf fundraising, we do that for the 6 days, all sorts of stuff. So it's cool. But the other one too, the second one was in Czechoslovakia, still on the junior trophy. I was the top American coming from the junior trophy. So that was kind of my career highlight of doing the 6 days. And then secondly, we won the junior trophy that year. So that was cool. But then the next year was in Cessnock, Australia. And I think we got third or something, but I remember it was super cool. And I remember, you know, my whole family went there because who doesn't want to go to Australia, right? I think we stopped in Hawaii on the way or something really cool. But I remember seeing the kangaroos when we're doing the special test walk, Rodney Smith and I, and seeing how far they were jumping the herds and walking and pacing off, how many feet is like 30 feet they were going, and all sorts of cool stuff. So I think everybody loves Australia anyway. So it was super 6 days for sure.
Lucky nobody hit one, because they scare the hell out of you when you know, like out where I've just got a couple of like just off-road practice tracks where I just go and pound laps just to keep fit near home, and they're nothing special because it's all very flat here. There's no hills, but there's a lot of kangaroos out there, and yeah, you're doing laps, but yeah, especially the first lap, because that the noise and that, they'll all clear off, they'll move away, but that first lap, you're really watching, you know. And if you see one, you back right off, because there's usually not just one, there's usually a bunch of mates coming. So yeah, but it's funny, people, you know, people do hit them on bikes, but it's very, very rare. So yeah, I have heard of it, but geez, I wouldn't want to do it. They you wouldn't fare too well, I think. So,
so. Yeah. They're huge. They're a lot bigger than I thought. And we saw the whole herd. Like you said, there's probably 20 or 30 of them. And they just went by when we were walking one of the special tests. And we were in awe. We're glad that they weren't going after us or over us or through us.
Yeah. They're pretty, they're not dumb. They're not aggressive unless, the only time, you see videos and things. It's usually when people's pets attack them and that sort of thing, and they'll get defensive. And the big ones are pretty badass if they've got to be, but they don't. They don't sort of just seek you out to take you on or anything like that. So it's pretty right like that. But you wouldn't. I reckon a big buck, man. That's the last thing in Australia that I'd walk up to and want to give any trouble. They'll mess you right up. Yeah. So cool. We might move on to talk a bit about training. So obviously you still just love the sport. To move from a racer into your training and you riding all the time still yourself. So you're obviously someone that just loves the sport. Why did you decide to get into training? Was it just a natural progression? Did you fall into it or was it a plan?
No plan. I planned on getting into business since I wanted to use my degrees. So funny story, I fell into it. Nate Caney, who is a really good GNCC racer, he was from New York and he was usually about fifth place and I was still racing. So I wasn't going to tell him any of my secrets because I didn't want him to beat me because I knew he probably would. So once I retired though, Nate Caney, Paul Carpenter, who is from New York, a supercross motocross guy.
Yep.
And Bob Canary, who is a supercross motocross kid back then too. So I'd train with those guys when I'd come back from Arizona and live in New York in the summer to get out of the heat. So once I retired, I was kind of working for another friend. We were doing real estate out in Arizona, different things, which was cool. But these guys, I'm like, you know what? I know what you guys are doing wrong. I'm going to help you. I'm not going to charge you a nickel and let's just see what you do. So that's how it went that first year. And Nate won 2 GNCCs and some other races. So he'd never been better than fifth. So that was cool. And I think Paul and Bob in Supercross and Motocross got some podiums, which they'd never even been really close to. So I was like, wow, that's really satisfying. I didn't break any bones training these guys like I probably would if I was racing. So being retired is not too bad. And then I was vicariously, feeling that excitement of their joy and accomplishment of getting their goals and dreams through them, which is, I think it's awesome to do it yourself if you can, but it's almost cooler to help somebody else on their journey. So that was kind of the start of it by mistake, not by design. And then in Arizona, the real estate crashed pretty hard. So that didn't help, doing real estate stuff. And I'm like, I'm just going to do this full time. And I loved it. So I just put all my eggs in the basket and went for it and been coaching, mentoring, and training riders ever since. And I'm the type of guy that doesn't really have a plan B. And I think that's a good way to be at times. It's probably, I do have some other options, obviously, but I think I'm either all in or I'm all out. So I don't try to do it halfway or have, 6 other things going on. So it's been really fun. It's really great to help. And, my wife and I say it and people know it. Everything's worth coaching dirt bikes and riders to be winners on their bike. But we all know that it's the same form and template as life, right? With the highs and the lows and what you have to deal with. So that's the big thing. We're helping riders become great humans, in our opinion, and helping them understand the highs and lows. And these aren't going to be forever, good or bad, and really being solid and, and steady in adversity and different things that we can really help walk them through. And, I always say, I don't always know the answer, but I've usually been there, wrecked that and done it wrong and try to figure out how to do it right. So that's one of the things that we're not really ever feel like we're great or we've arrived, but we definitely work really hard. My wife and I really enjoy the coaching, mentoring and training and pushing these riders and they get that. And we both, like I mentioned before, kind of come at it 2 different ways. She works on, my wife Denise is awesome and works on the mindset, powerthemind.coach is the company, but, and I've always worked with them on that too, but they can kind of really see myself on, I stay kind of in our lanes. Mine's more training on the bike, time on the bike, riding, race stuff. And then she's more on the mindset and she can do nutrition and training if she wanted to, but it's mostly mindset now with the riders. But it's kind of cool because we come from two different perspectives, two different ways, and kind of masculine, feminine. I'm pretty more just roll up the sleeves, get it done. And she can do that too, but she's, you know, obviously more kinder, if you will, in a good way. And I'm nice, but you can get stuff differently from these riders, especially the young riders. They come more in compared to us, in my opinion, the old school guys. It's black or white, and it's, you know, there's so much of the not, you know, it used to be mostly masculine and not as much feminine, but now the young ones are coming in with both, which is awesome, meaning they have feelings and they're not just, you know, that'll make it tough. Like a lot of our dads told us, or wipe the blood off your nose and get back on it, which that's a good way to have it also. Yeah. But they're also can absorb, I should say, a lot of information through both sides, which is really neat to see too.
Especially for what you're saying about like life, you know, like, you know, you can't go through your whole life just being, you know, just being like just chewing on nails and you know, like just being the tough guy all the time. You know, it's that's not good for you as a long term thing in life. Yeah, we might work a little bit on race day, but yeah, the mental side sounds really, really interesting, man. So you know, I've said on a lot of shows that I myself have a history of mental health issues, you know, in my teenage years and my young adult years, and struggled greatly with a lot of things like that. And that I could do a 4-hour show just on my life and my journey around that. And certainly dirt bikes is what kept me going for a lot of years. My love of that as well as of course my family. And I've been well from that those struggles for a lot of years. But yeah, I do certainly, I think because of what I learned about myself and learn about other people and learn about the mental side of life, I find that stuff, yeah, super, super interesting. Might have to get do a show with your wife at some stage. Hey, and
talk. Yeah, that'd be great. She'd love it. We do a lot of them too together or whatever, or get her on there. She'd love it. Mm. Yeah, as you know, it's everything, you know. I think at any level, when you can get, you know, and especially just simplistically on a dirt bike, it's, you know, everybody at the top levels fit, everybody's fast, and then 90% of it's mental. And if you can get that mental there to show up, and you're going to have peaks and valleys just like life. And just like you said, so many struggle with that on the mindset and in life, and even now more than ever. So we try to really help cultivate and talk about it. And the good news about today compared to, you know, 20, 30, 50 years ago is it's okay. And people are good with talking about it a lot more. Yes. So that's super cool. Cause it's, you know, before it was kind of, you know, if you wanted to be tough, you didn't want to say anything. And that's a little trick for tough guys.
And that's it. And I didn't say anything about how I was going for years, for decades, you know. So
yeah,
and since I've started, I it was a fairly big deal at the time. I didn't just tell my best friends. I told the world. I did a Facebook video talking about my struggles, and it got a huge amount of response and all that sort of thing. And that was the first time even my family outside of like my wife. I think my wife and my doctors are probably the only people that knew how much I'd struggled in life. And then I did this Facebook video on it. And since then, my best friends, you know, and a couple of my best mates are like real big, burly man's men, alpha male types, you know, like we'll talk about feelings and how we're going in life and actually open up. And even my dad, who is the most stoic old bugger that you would ever come across, he even talks about struggles that he's had in life, and it turns out that mental health, you know, that depression problem runs in the family. It is great that we do talk about it nowadays. Yeah, absolutely. You've trained some pretty awesome guys, man. So like Ryan Sipes, Taylor Robert. Yeah, do you want to just tell us a bit about those? Like, I guess maybe even like, what's your your greatest, but maybe your favorite achievement of someone you've trained?
Yeah, well, I've definitely been blessed to do what I love and then do the passion and purpose on racing and then get into the training. But ironically, with Taylor Robert, we moved to Arizona from Northern California when I was living up there and training and racing. And he lived three doors down, like the band, and he was 7 years old. And I was kind of in my prime and probably one of the fastest times. I think it was 97. So anyway, we literally, my wife and I were driving down the dirt road looking where we wanted to buy. And I see dirt bikes outside this garage. Of course, my head swivels and I'm like, cool, I already like the area. You know, who cares what the house looks like? So we literally bought the house that day. And then moved everything from California down there. But so Taylor was, like I said, 7 years old when I met him. He was into moto, he and his dad and his brother and his mom, a great family. And then he kind of, right about 12, 13, remember having the meeting in my office, and that was just kind of getting out of it, I think, of my career. Let me back up. Just before that, he was training some with me, but he was doing motocross, and that was kind of his main gig. And he actually trained hard with me. He would come to my garage where I had my weights set up, and I remember on purpose putting it there at 5 a.m., 5 to 6 on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, that he had come down and trained with me. And he was, you know, like 12 or whatever, pretty young, and I wasn't putting huge weight on him, but just to see if he'd show up. And he showed up every time, without fail, never late. And I was like, who is this kid? And, you know, he's not like any other 12-year-old, you know, he's determined. So fast forward a few years, he got hurt a few times in moto, and his mom and dad and him sat down in my office, and I'd retired by then, and said, hey, you know, we want to see your opinion. Should he go moto or off-road? And I'm like, oh, you're talking to the wrong guy if you don't want me to talk him into off-road, because I'm going to talk him into off-road because it's been great to me. And I did come from moto originally, but I think, in my opinion, off-road is just super fun. All are really cool. I'm a big fan of all of it, obviously. But as far as a racer, and it's not the fortune and fame and money as much, but I think it's just a good time. And I knew Taylor how good he was as a young guy. So we started training him full-time on our program and working with him and riding with him. And I was riding a lot with him. We, like I said, we were neighbors, so it was pretty easy. And yeah, he was just freaking nature from day one to you name it. And I remember doing a little like wheelie, wheel tap triple on his little bike. And I think he was on like a 65 or maybe an 85 at the time. He was super small. I remember going out there, and for most guys, it took, you know, whatever, 15 minutes to a half hour or more sometimes, or less, depending on their talent. And I remember showing him on my dirt bike, and then he turns around and he does it. And I'm like, yeah, that was it, Taylor. Good job. Yeah, do it again. Thinking there's no way he's going to do it again. You know, we're going to be here a while. Riot, bink, bump. He did it again. I'm like, really? Do it one more time. Riot, bink, bump. I'm like, okay, we're out of here. On to the next section and on to the new coaching, because he was like just a sponge and really, really good at his talent from a young age. And so anyway, it's been really cool to see his career. He's, you know, kind of been like almost a second son to us, my wife and I, and their whole family's great. So really cool to see him and his career and succeed. And I know he just retired. I just saw him actually a couple weekends ago in Page, Arizona at a hard enduro. He was up there with some buddies and we got to hang out, but it's always like old times. So that's cool. And then, like you said, some of the other riders like Ryan Sipes, he was in Supercross Motocross when we started working with him on mindset to begin with. And then he saw that we were doing all this stuff on training, and he kind of jumped in full gamut. So we worked with him in motocross, supercross for his career, and then when he got into off-road, even more. So we've been with him forever, and just great people, great families, great everything. And then other riders from Caleb Russell to Johnny Girard in the last few years, Ben Kelly to Josh Toth now, and a bunch of them. So been really blessed to be around some great riders. But you know, I think the biggest thing with those guys is they're coachable. And, you know, we've had a lot of talent come to us, didn't talk to my wife and I, like, hey, we want to do your program. We're very selective, especially now, because we've done it a long time. But coachability is everything. And if they already think they know what they're doing or don't want to listen or whatever, which is fine, I get it, don't waste their time and finances or ours. So I think those guys and gals that we really enjoy are the ones that just absorb everything and are just chasing you down to get more information. And they just are relentless. They never, ever give up. They never have excuses. I mean, they're just the full champions in sport and in life. So it's really cool to see.
Mm. Oh yeah, I get what you mean, man. You know, like certainly not at your level, but I've in work environments, I've been involved with training a lot of young people, a lot of teenagers in to do. Yeah, and I know what you mean there. Where some people they just know everything already, you know, and they don't want to listen, and whereas others will listen to you. So yeah, that is cool. What's your sort of, what are you, I think you probably have sort of already answered it. What you really love in a student, I guess, is being coachable. But is there, do you get like, I'm sure you get different types. You'll get that sort of crazy scatterbrain kid who's, you know, all over the place, but he's got good energy, like full of energy, but a bit of a scatterbrain. How do you sort of get around those kids?
Yeah, so it's not easy, right? So you always have to figure out who you're really dealing with, just like anything. So we start out with like a 5-page evaluation and understand the individual, because our programs individualize on the big programs especially. So, you know, we ask and figure out what empowers them, what disempowers them, what they think's good and bad, where their strengths and weaknesses are. The fastest way to get somebody better is to work on their weaknesses. Our humanness wants to work on our strengths, because we love, like, I love seat hopping and playing in the woods, but that I don't need to work on. I need to work on slimy tree roots in a corner, you know? So I think that's the thing, is finding the right riders. And then, like you said, if it's somebody that's really all over the place, you really, there's things you can do to help structure them. I think most riders, for good or bad, probably came or have some sort of ADD to take in so much information. But on the flip side, that's pretty wild when you try to contain them. So it's like this fine balance, because you don't want to change the rider to, you know, or, and they're not going to like you much either if you try to completely change them. But I think you just play to where they're at. Try to stay a few steps ahead of them, not be 100 miles up the mountain and not be below them, but just pull them along on the path of coachability. And then understand and get them to understand, hey, you can be wild and crazy and all over the place, but that doesn't help you settle for 3 hours. You can be wild and crazy for maybe one lap on a motocross track, but for 3 hours, you got to figure out a way to stay focused and to stay present minded and not to be wild and crazy. So, and that true with some other guys, we try to get them up for the game or the race, if you will, that are just almost too monotone. So it's like that perfect storm, in my opinion, seeing all these guys and a lot of successful racers, especially we've been lucky to work with. They're smart, they're determined, and they're relentless, but they're also fiery. So if they can't do something, they're not like, ah, whatever, I won't care. They're like, oh, you know, let's do it again and again. We'll spend 100 times trying to get it, be it Taylor Robert or Ryan Sipes or Caleb or any of these guys, including myself, as far as that relentless pursuit to get to that next level, where a lot of people are just like, well, this is dumb, I'm obviously not getting it, I'm moving on, you know? And those are the guys that are not always winning or going to find a way, if you will. So I think that's, it's really fun to learn who they are. And like I said, you have to know that, or else you're just kind of throwing a sheet over everybody. And that doesn't work, especially in today's age.
Yeah. I love hearing you say about, I love all of that, man. I love all of that. I love the questionnaire, the getting to know people, so you can, you know, tailor your training to suit them, that sort of thing. I think that's great, because I think there is, you know, not to pick on anyone else, but, you know, I'm certainly not going to name names, so I'm not picking anyone, but I think there's trainers out there where it's a real, this is my way, everybody should do it my way, this is the model to win, so everyone does it the same, you know, which I as a person, I just don't agree with, because I'm a very different sort of person. So yeah. It's that's cool. I've been our very first sort of training thing that happens, it's a Motorcycling Australia thing too. So to start racing off-road as a little kid, you got to do a program called Kickstart, which I've helped run those before. And yeah, that's awesome. I asked about the scatterbrain kids, because they're my favorite. I love those kids because of the energy, like, and sometimes they'll be frustrating, but I love those kids. And it's just real simple stuff. Like, we'll even teach them how to pick their bike up, you know, because sometimes little kids, you know, they try and pick their bike up like this, you know, and it's nah, just turn the bars and pick it up like this, you get more leverage, and just little things like that. Because sometimes if they're stuck somewhere, they might be waiting on a sweep rider just to pick their bike up. If they can pick their bike up, they can keep going. And and just do like stand up drills, slow ride drills, you know, and they spend all day yelling at kids to look up. That's the main thing you're saying all day. Or that, and feet on the pegs, look up, feet on the pegs, look up. You get sick of saying that. You need that on a loop over a PA, just going the whole day. But it's good fun, you know, the energy. That was always my favorite thing when I was helping run off-road events, was the little kids, helping the little kids. I'd love to sweep ride the small wheels race, as we'd call it, you know, that sweep ride that and just the energy of it. Or even one of the funniest things, it always makes me laugh every time I think about it. You know, you'd get a senior guy or a sweep rider to lead a sight lap for the small wheels race. And that is the funniest thing, because, you know, that 65 age riders are just the craziest, I reckon. And you'd be riding around and they know they're not allowed to pass the guy that's leading the sight lap, but they're so amped up. It's like you got three under each armpit. You can see all these different colored guards just going bip, 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 bip under your elbows. And they so want to pass you and go as fast as they can. But you'd be slowing them up because they're supposed to be looking at the track, you know. But they just like, it's already let me race there. Yeah. The energy, if you could bottle the energy of a line of 65 riders, you could probably fix any problem with the world with that energy. I think it's so good.
Totally agree with that.
Fantastic. Who's your current rider lineup, Steve?
So right now we've got Josh Toth, who's been killing it. He just won the overall from the XC2 row, which has never been done. So that was cool. He won this last weekend, Louisiana. National Enduro. We've got a few other ones that are coming up that are strong. Grant Davis, who's actually doing the mindset stuff with us. He's actually training and on the KTM team with Caleb Russell. So he's been doing great though, but he's battling for the championship in the XC2 class. And then a lot of them, we have now some are hard enduro riders, one from Hawaii that was a pro surfer that's now into being a hard enduro guy. We've got a full gamut of riders from all over the place. I'm looking at my phone here with the locations, but it's pretty cool when I look at it because that always blows my mind. So let's see, Texas, Utah, Ohio, New York, Texas, Ohio, Hawaii, Pennsylvania, Florida, and California. So like the riders we're working with on our big program, they're from all over. So that's, I think it's super cool because it keeps my wife and I entertained with, you know, it's not the same and they all do different series. So we're coaching on different formats, different things that we're working on. And I really, for the big programs, we work on them and talk with them Monday and build our whole program for the week on Tuesday and send it out. So we know what they're doing every single day and they call in or if they have anything going on or need any answers, but super fun. We've got a lot of cool riders and it's fun to watch them thrive.
Awesome. Awesome. That's fantastic, man. Hey, yeah, it's time to do an ad read. Time for me to do an ad read. So I don't know what sort of seats you run on your bike, but here at the Outside Gate, we're sponsored by Guts Racing. So in 1990, Jamie Gregg, Andy's dad, he fired up Gregg's Ultra Trick seats. And I've been saying it's lucky that he was a Californian and to come up with that real Ultra Trick. It's a real Cali thing. Because if he was an Australian, they probably would have been called something like Gregg's Fair Dinkum Seats, you know, which that wouldn't have sounded right at all, would it? The premier seat brand of the world, I'm going to say internationally. You see them on the line of MXGP, Guts Racing seats just podiumed the first Aussie Motocross Nationals. The all three riders on the MX1 podium were on Guts seats. And just out there dominating riders like Ken Roxon, even Phil Nicoletti, Chiz. I got the Chiz jersey just behind me here. Mookie, all the Rockstar Husqvarna bikes. Who else? Phoenix Honda, PRMX Kawasaki, Next Level KTM, AEO KTM, and countless privateers all running gut seats. So if you're not running a gut seat, you need to have a good hard look at yourself. And if you are keen to get one, and you should be, gutsracing.com is very easy to remember. Gutsracing.com. It's a great website. You can go on there. It's very easy. I just actually ordered a seat just this week for my Yamaha I bought recently. And I went with we're just not getting too flash. Just going the YZ blue with the black gripper strips on it. And you go in there. You can pick your color for the side, for the top, for the stripes. Whether you want the ballistic if you're wearing knee braces and you're tearing up the sides there, you can get the ballistic material on the sides, foams, you name it. So yeah, gutsracing.com. Go and get around that. Cool, Steve. We might just move in just a few just random, funny, different questions that I have that I like to do towards the end of the show. And so a 48-year-old C grader, what three things would you give me to practice?
Great question. So I think the most important thing is the top three will definitely be, I call them the ABCs. The A is on acceleration, the B is on braking, the C is on cornering. Yep. So that's 90% of what you do. So in my opinion, like an oval, like straight down, maybe second, third gear straightaway with a hairpin turn as tight as you can turn, and then straightaway back and another hairpin turn. And it should look like a perfect paper clip, not yep. wide and going crazy. You should have one line, even if you ride it 1,000 laps, it should look like one bike line tire width. So if you can do that, though, that's probably the biggest thing, is getting that style of riding and then getting the foundation correct. I always say on the body positioning, it's like building a skyscraper. If it's off a little low, you can only go up a little ways, it's going to tip over. But if you get the foundation correct on your form, the elbows up, symmetrical, clamp it with your legs, balance your head up, like you said, with the kids' eyes up, and that'll build your foundation. And then with your skyscraper, if it's got a good foundation, you can go up 100 stories just like they do in the city. So foundation's everything. Building that little oval. And then thirdly, if you got three things you can do, I was just riding myself a couple hours ago and doing a video on this, so it's fresh in my head. But when you're practicing, if you can do that oval and you can do 10 laps down and around, and they don't have to be wide open. I do them about 50% of your speed, because you want to have the perfect form. If you go to your 100% speed, you won't have enough brain width to actually get the right form added in if you don't have it. So slow down, get the right form, really work on it. But if you can go through those corners, the first one to sit down with your foot out like moto style, but don't drag your foot. I always pretend it's like 100 pushups or $100 if you tap your foot on the ground. So keep your feet on the away from the ground, keep it up high, but try to do like 10 laps to the left and then do 10 laps to the right. For me, when I was a pro, I'd do them without dabbing, or if I messed up, I'd start at zero again. So I would do, sometimes felt like way too many, but by the end of my career, I could usually do them without getting in too much trouble, without making any mistakes. But then the second one's doing 10 laps to the left standing up, 10 laps to the right standing up. So you'll have to slip your clutch and use a lot of balance in the ruts. And they'll get deeper and deeper. And then the last one's sitting down again, but without your foot sticking out. So you got your feet kind of more on the front part of your foot peg, like a runner on a starting block. It helps keep your pelvis forward. Once you're on in front of the foot pegs, it'll weight the front end and get it so your bike actually turns and gets more grip. So if you kind of do those three things, that'll help you a ton with getting better for sure.
All right. I'm going to try it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do okay, it. I'm going to let you know how it works out for me. if you can help me, you can help anyone. So
well, that's my goal. So send me the video, ask me questions.
Yeah. I'll get my daughter to video a before and after for you.
There you go. Yeah. I like it.
Steve, who was your childhood hero? So it could have been a moto person or anyone, you know, whatever you like. Yeah.
So two people, you'll like this, coming from car racing. I always wanted to be a Formula One driver, of course, like who doesn't, right? So Niki Lauda was my favorite guy. And actually Watkins Glen here in New York is literally 45 minutes from here. My grandparents live close enough to hear the race cars there. That's how my dad got into the race cars and cars. But Niki Lauda was my hero. And I did end up getting his autograph years ago. I was, I think, like 6 years old. But my parents say I just like stood in front of him because he hardly ever gave any autographs to the fans very often. So I still got that autograph. So that was cool. And then in off-road slash moto is Bob Hanna. And we became friends later. And he actually helped me, told Suzuki, hey, you need to hire this kid, Steve, from New York. He's going to be somebody, to the boss, top guy at Suzuki, once he got to know me. And we did some training camps together. But he was definitely my hero, and getting to know him, he was super cool.
Awesome. That's a couple of good ones, man. Yeah. So yeah. My dad raced cars. He, that's how I ended up racing cars a little bit as well. And, I remember I had a Niki Lauda poster on my wall as a kid. So as well as motorbike stuff, you know, there was always motorbike and car stuff because dad's a car guy. And I was a fan of that guy. I've read, he's got a great book. I can nearly see it from here. What was it called? If you haven't read his book, I can't see it from here. If you haven't read his book, it's fantastic. His autobiography. It's really, really good. Yeah, yeah. Goes through everything and right through to, you know, when he met his wife and that. And yeah. It's awesome. A lot of really cool stuff. Okay. I reckon there wouldn't be too much left, but is there still anything on your riding bucket list, places you'd like to ride? I know you've been around the world a fair bit, but yeah, is there anywhere you still haven't thrown some roost?
Yeah, good question. I haven't thought of that one much, honestly. I've been blessed to race in so many states, like 48 of the 50, and then 12 different countries. So I've seen a bunch. Probably to do some again would be the best one. I do like the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. It's kind of sandy, but it's like a hard sand and really rough, so you can almost moto through the trees. It was my first time I ever won a off-road pro race. Was a two-day qualifier up there, and a bunch of enduros I won up there over the years. But it's super fun, and probably just because it fits my style, that aggressiveness, fit right in and sending it off the little. It felt like motoing through the woods. That was just, you had to see it ahead of time and obviously know to jump it or to wheel tap it or do whatever you're doing. But it's still one of my probably favorite places in the world I've ever ridden.
Cool. Awesome. What do you do when it's time to relax and it's you're away from dirt bikes for a little while, or if there is, what do you do to relax?
Relax.
Yeah. You see, it's like you're a bit like me. There isn't.
Yeah. No off switch. There's no off switch on a tiger, right? Like my mom used to always joke.
Yeah.
I'm not very good at relaxing, but I do try to do some. My wife's into yoga and meditation and all that, which I try to do a little. I'm not great at it, but I need it very much to calm down. But I do love the outdoors. We love mountain biking with my wife and my daughter and having fun and vacationing and traveling. So I think it's a lot of those. And just still being outdoors and being athletic and enjoying the journey.
Cool. Here's a fun one. Who was your like teenage celebrity crush when you were a young bloke? Like for me, it was Kelly Bundy. So like who was that for you? I was too embarrassed to have a Kelly Bundy poster on my wall, but that's the one that would have been up there if I did. Who was that for you?
Oh, wow. I have to think back. Probably the, I'm trying to remember her name now. Probably Daisy Duke on the Dukes of Hazzard.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah,
back in the day.
That's a good one for sure. Yeah, I loved that show, but we didn't get it much.
Oh, but, no, really?
Yeah, we didn't get it all the time. Where I grew up, like, we had two TV channels. So
we had one.
We had the government channel, and then we had, like, the local one, and they would just pull shows from all over the place for their, you know, they had deals or whatever. And every now and again, we'd get Dukes of Hazzard, and I just loved it. Like, I loved all, you know, all those cool old shows, and I had the toy cars and all that sort of thing. And yeah, I've still got one sitting over there with all me cool stuff. And yeah, So now Daisy Duke, that's a good one, man. And then, yeah, what scares you, man? Does anything scare you? Everyone's got to have something, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm scared of heights, believe it or not, which nobody believes because I'll hit big jumps and everything else. But I'm not scared of heights on my bike. I'm just scared of heights when I'm on something tall. And I remember what happened. We were actually at the World Trade Centers, which are unfortunately gone now. But we were way at the top, and I was probably like 10 years old. And I remember we got to the top, and they kind of, you can kind of look down if I remember right. And I remember looking over, and somebody said, yeah, they can sway, I think it was 18 feet one way or the other. And I remember looking at the other World Trade Center, it was dark, and seeing it come closer and then go farther away, yeah. And then looking down. And I remember that moment, I was like, oh my God, I was paranoid. And I remember after that, my mom, dad, and sister, they wanted to go up in the Empire State Building to the top of the needle. Back then you could, I don't know if you still can, but and I was having a conniption. I was like, you guys can't go. I went like to the one floor, but not all the way to the, we went way up, but not to the top of the needle. But I remember that night, it was like instantaneously. I've gotten better, and I worked construction some before and summer job stuff when I was going to college and stuff. So I got better with it. But yeah, heights and then definitely snakes. Those two things I'm not good with.
Well, you got plenty of snakes there. We got plenty of snakes here too. So yeah, I'm pretty right with snakes, but yeah, height. I've sort of got me limits. Like I could be on a third story because I do construction. I could be on a third story roof or whatever. No problem at all. Like I don't care. But there's no chance you're getting me to jump out of an airplane or a bungee jump or anything like that. Like no chance. That's not happening. So, you know, I think there must be just a certain limit where it's like, nah, that's too high. That's not happening. But yeah,
that's exactly right. I say that there's no way I'd jump out of a perfectly good airplane. If it's on fire or like it's the last resort, then maybe, but I'd probably go down with the airplane for sure.
Yeah, it's fun. And also too, it's lucky that I'm not, because my dad's scared of heights. That's his thing. Yeah, he's not scared of heights. He's scared of heights. So I used to get sent up the ladder to do stuff as a kid. You know, I'm not a little kid, of course, but you know, teenager, I guess. Like you know, if we if they needed something, you know, done up up a ladder, it was like, boy, you know, I need you to get up the ladder. So like, yeah, so lucky I wasn't. Cool, yeah. Cool, Steve. There's a couple of fun things I do to close out the show. Awesome. The first one is give me your best Aussie accent.
Good day, mate.
Jeez, that's pretty good. Do that again.
Good day, mate.
Jeez, that's pretty bloody good. Yeah, you're up around there. Stuff, but you're up there, great. Yeah. That was pretty good. Yeah, you definitely... there's too many to work out exactly, but I reckon you're on the podium. I reckon that was pretty good.
Okay, well, good. That's awesome.
That was pretty good.
I do better once I hear it. If you said something, I could mimic it.
Yeah, good day, mate.
Good day, mate.
Yeah.
Good day, mate.
Yeah, you're pretty good. You're pretty good. I like that. I like that. Well done.
I might be over there moving in sometime.
Yeah.
Next 10 years.
That's the way. All right. And the very last thing I do, man, you might have seen this or whatever. Funny story, and it's nothing too serious, but I sing a little bit of Kenny Rogers to close out the show. So if you're familiar with Kenny Rogers, the gambler, and you want to join in to the chorus or whatever, then go for your life. So, but most people don't. So don't stress about it. So I handed him my bottle and he drank down my last swallow. Then he bummed a cigarette and asked me for a light. And the night got deathly quiet. And his face lost all expression. Said, if you're going to play the game, boy, you got to learn to play it right. You got to know when to hold him.
When to hold him.
Well, when to fold him.
When to fold him.
Know when to walk away. Know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting.
When the dealing's done.
Thanks, man. I love when people join in. Thank you very much, Steve, for your time. And, yeah, good luck with everything. Good luck with your races and your training and everything, man. And I'll be I'll be very, very keen to talk to you again at some stage.
Sounds great. Let's we'll get my wife on here doing the power of the mind, and appreciate Absolutely. It, Steve.
And Super interested in that stuff, as I said. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you. And thanks for everybody listening and watching, and keep rocking over there. It's awesome that you're doing this.